your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. We're going to be covering the first hour and a rally that was held in Charlottesville, Virginia, last weekend, last Friday and Saturday of last week, and it was held to try to preserve the monuments there of Robert E. Lee, a Confederate, and there's a move to take down these statues. So, who was there was to defend those statues and from being taken down, but also it had elements of free speech. But the parties that made up that far-right group that was in the park, Emancipation Park and Lee Park, were like Ku Klux Klan, white supremacists, white nationalists, just everyday citizens. And I'd say patriots mixed in there too, see. I would have not preferred, or I would not have advised anyone, I would say patriots or good American citizens to join, have joined in with those very, very radical groups of the KKK and so forth to be there, because then it arises that you might be associating somewhat with those groups. And so I wouldn't advise anyone out here in the so-called patriot movement to join in with those particular elements of our society. And they comprise a very small minority, and they don't even come close to characterizing the average good tax-paying American Republican type member. Well, anyway, we're going to play a clip here to start this program off of the MTP Meet the Press of last Sunday, and Chuck Todd is the host. And we're going to play this clip because it's the way the program began, and it's about the President Trump's moral authority. So here we go right now.
If it's Wednesday, the Republican Party has a choice to make.
Tonight, the search for moral authority. After the president's two sides conflation, will Republicans continue to allow the president to define their party?
I stand with the president. And I stand by those words.
Plus, going out of business. The president dissolves his business advisory councils after an exodus of CEOs. Is President Trump too toxic for corporate America? And confronting the challenges of dealing with hundreds of Confederate monuments still standing in public spaces throughout the country. This is MTB Daily, and it starts right now.
Well, good evening. I'm Chuck Todd here at headquarters in New York City, and welcome to MTP Daily. Folks, for all the Republicans who criticize the president for missing the moment in Charlottesville, this is arguably their moment. And frankly, the rest of the Republican Party seems paralyzed by it. They are coming to grips with the fact that Mr. Trump and his nationalist views aren't just a stain on the party. They're becoming a tattoo. White supremacists and white nationalists are cheering what the president said yesterday. Some seem to be brimming with hope that he will deliver their vision of a white ethno-state.
Boy, they're saying that he's going to deliver on the, you know, on his promise of a white ethno-state. He never ever made a promise of a white ethno-state to any group, period. This is all propaganda. We're looking at propaganda from the very, very highest level on down. This is so getting so full of lies and distortions that it's becoming really, really on the level of Goebbels in Germany. I mean, he would be proud of what some of this propaganda that I'm beginning to hear coming out of our national media. And this thing is totally distorted. My God, now we have Michael Beslow's is a historian, and he adds to this idea that somehow President Trump is something wrong with him, and he's not capable, and that we've had ways to deal with these presidents in the past. And he's trying to give us some of this great wisdom, and this is adding fuel to the fire in trying to get rid of Trump. They've created a plethora of ideas of white nationalism and white, you know what I mean, racism itself. And so it's very, very discouraging, and this country's in trouble. And I want to hear you to hear this little clip from Beslow's here in a second. That's coming up right now.
I guess, Michael, I'll go back to where we started this conversation. If the president doesn't have the moral authority to sort of help us get through this, heal us a little bit, right? If that's not, who do you turn to?
Well, the idea of the founders was that, thank God, we not have a system that is so dependent on a president that, you know, otherwise it can't function if you have a president who's not good. And you have to look to the courts, you have to look to the Congress, and you also have to look at American citizens to say, you know, whoa, what was said yesterday was not right, and if we normalize this, you know, this could be the beginning of the end of democracy.
You see how they're using this? If we normalize this, this could be the end of democracy. And he never once equated any of his views with any white nationalist view or anything like that. Trump never said that. On the campaign trail, and I listened to most of his speeches throughout the nation when he was traveling before the election, and he kept to a very, very conservative, you could say, campaign. And he talked about things that really the average American is interested in and concerned about. These people today are taking this Charlottesville incident, and it wasn't a good incident. And I don't support what the KKK stands for, or the white supremacists, or the white separatists, or any of that. I do not stand for that. My family has worked against that in this area over the years, over the decades. When I was in school, I never exhibited anything supportive of segregation or any discrimination against any minority. So let me just tell my listening audience where I stand on that. And I think anyone that knows me will back that statement up. These people today, they want to drive him out, so they have to create a campaign of discrediting him and setting him up for dismissal, or even worse. This is building up and trying to establish in the average American's mind that Trump is no good, and he's a racist, and he likes those KKK people. Really backing him up, and secretly deep down in his heart, that's really what he had said. And Krauthammer was saying that today. And I'll tell you what, I've got to get Laura. I've got to give her a lot of credit on pounding him to pieces. And we're going to later on after the speech. Now, later in this Meet the Press, there was an interview with Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Mark Bray. Okay, Mark Bray represents Antifa, and he's written several books, a couple of books. I think this latest book is Antifa Handbook. And it's supposed to be published in September, that which is right here. We're on the doorstep of that now. And I think it is up on Amazon for pre-order. But he's also written another book about anarchism and the Occupy movement, which took place a couple of years ago. Now, in that Wall Street book, I went in that he's written, and try and scan through to see if the Federal Reserve was mentioned in there. It wasn't. And so my idea is that But much of the highest, the elites, they'll control both the left and the right. And it looks more and more like, to me, that Charlottesville was being controlled by the ultra-elitist capitalist, you could say. They're controlling the ultra-left and they're controlling the ultra-right. And that's what we had a confrontation of in Charlottesville. And Pachinik has said that David Duke had been funded by the CIA in the past. I don't know if that's the truth, but I'll credit Pachinik with that. He's appeared on many talk shows. He has his own site now. He was CIA, or still is. But he has some knowledge about the funding of David Duke in the past. So we're looking at people that came in like David Duke on this, and he had some organizational experience in doing this before, and there's indications by his very words that he did partake in the organization of this. He wasn't one of the key organizers, but he added to the organization. And several of the, you could say, the slogans that were being shouted by some of the marchers on Friday night, the torch bearers, you could say, could be possibly alluded to David Duke. But they were like anti-Jew type of sayings. Some of the sayings were, Jews will not replace us. Another one was, blood and soil. Okay. And so I looked up and did research on this. And this blood and soil does relate back to German, the Blut und Boden. And it's about defying the German mentality or the nationality in the sense of the farmers that would fight for their country, see. And then the Jews will not replace us. Some that say that Comus is involved in that, or it can be related back to the teachings of Renault Comus in France. But you can look up some of those references and see if you can get any tags on that in the internet. Well, anyway, what's coming up next is that I'm going to play a clip. It's about 6-7 minutes long. It's an NPR clip of an interview that was done with Mark Bray weeks ago. And he states in there, you'll have to listen to the clip first, but he'll state in there that yes, violence, Antifa does promulgate violence, and that they believe that that is the way to further their interest and their to reach their goals. Well, anyway, I want you to hear that right now. That's coming up right now.
So the liberal idea that in a marketplace of ideas, the good ideas will rise to the top and the bad will drop out the bottom, they don't buy that. You don't buy that either?
Well, unfortunately, terrible ideas have risen to the top throughout history. The liberal ideal is that the government is a referee in a game that all parties are invited to play. But in actual fact, whenever left groups have become threatening, you get Red Scares, you get repression, you get COINTELPRO in the 1960s and 70s. And so essentially anti-fascists are arguing that we want a political content to how we look at speech in society, which is drastically different from a liberal take, and that this entails shutting down the extreme manifestations of fascism and neo-Nazism. And we need to recognize that this is not simply a question of whether a fascist government will come to power or not. I'm skeptical that such a explicitly fascist government would come to be, but that those who carry out hate crimes, they feel emboldened when their ideas become mainstream. And so the idea with anti-fascist politics is to prevent those ideas from having that opportunity.
But where does it stop? I mean, how are we different from our fascist opponents if we both subscribe to the idea that speech should be repressed when we regard the message to be dangerous?
Germany has a prohibition against advocating for Nazis publicly. That doesn't mean that Germany is a closed society where people can't say whatever they want to say. You can have some prohibitions against speech without going all the way. In the context of an increasing number of hate crimes, the Southern Poverty Law Center cited over 800 such crimes immediately following the election of President Trump. The idea is that the people who carry out these crimes are listening to Richard Spencer speeches, going on Stormfront websites, imbibing this hateful doctrine, and that to the degree that we can shut it down, we will make fewer people copycatting them into attacking vulnerable populations. most people would agree that it was acceptable in the 1930s and 1940s to organize armed resistance to the Nazi regime. The question is, how terrible does it have to be before that becomes legitimate? And the anti-fascist answer is, you need to nip it in the bud from the beginning.
You wrote that, quote, liberals tend to examine issues of sexism or racism in terms of the question of belief or what is in one's heart. What is often overlooked in such conversations, you said, is that what one truly believes is sometimes much less important than what social constraints allow that person to articulate or act upon.
Right. So the message that I'm trying to get across with that is we have a certain set of societal taboos around what one can say and can't say, and those have shifted over time. The words that are acceptable to use about different ethnic minorities, about women, about all sorts of groups have shifted over time, and the way that I think that we maintain a firm barrier against the alt-right, making racism okay again, making sexism okay again, is to really increase the social cost of presenting oppressive views out in public, so that when someone like Donald Trump says something sexist, we raise a ruckus, we disrupt business as usual to make it so that it's not acceptable to raise these views in public, increase the social cost of that being able to be a public discourse and push back through politics.
So what does the American Antifa movement look like? What are its tactics?
Under that specific banner, it's still relatively new and is finding its way. But a lot of anti-fascist or Antifa groups have formed in different cities around the United States. A lot of what they do is researching information on local white supremacists, who they are, where they live, where they work, sometimes pressuring their employers to get them fired, sometimes making sure that if they organize private events at local venues for white supremacists, they pressure the venue owner to try and cancel the event. So that research and coalition building with groups that are affected by various forms of fascist or white supremacist violence is a lot of what's done. What gets more of the headlines is when the demonstrations come out onto the street. And so, as I'm sure you and a number of listeners are well aware, there have been high-profile instances recently, such as in Berkeley, of trying to physically shut down events that has raised the profile of anti-fascism.
Physically confronting people, that's part of the strategy, right?
Yes, it is. It's an illiberal politics of social revolutionism applied to fighting the far right.
In a recent article, you advocated for everyday anti-fascism. That is, anti-fascism right. That goes beyond, quote, punching Nazis.
Right. So these glamorous topics, you know, the video of Richard Spencer getting punched got millions and millions of shares. But if we want to think about how to create an anti-racist society, an anti-sexist society, we need to think about the everyday interactions that we have with each other at our workplaces, in our families, among our friends, and say, if someone is articulating a homophobic perspective or prejudicial against immigrants, am I doing what I can to try and change their mind? Am I raising some sort of opposition, or am I tacitly going along with it because I'm just letting it slide? And so everyday anti-fascism is not having any tolerance for intolerance. It's not agreeing to disagree about hateful behavior, and it's saying, look, if you're going to be part of my life, you need to shape up. You can't treat people like this. You can't say things like this. And holding people accountable. And ultimately, sometimes that means you need to end some friendships, or it means maybe you should boycott the business down the street that's been rude to Latino immigrants.
You say that our goal should be that in 20 years, those who voted for Trump are too uncomfortable to share that in public.
Raise the social cost of being a bigot. And sometimes that's enough to make it so someone doesn't feel empowered to act on it in a way that puts people in jeopardy. But there is a growing radical sector of the left in the United States that is simply not going to take any chances with the possibility of alt-right politics becoming the mainstream. We have a Breitbart editor and white supremacist in the White House. We're not that many steps away from a situation where a crisis unfolds, the Trump administration uses some sort of emergency authorization to centralize power. And so if we want to make it so that alt-right ideas are not taken seriously, the anti-fascist argument is that you don't even let them start to have that kind of platform in society. This is the norm of anti-fascist politics in Europe, where many people remember the legacies of living under the Franco regime, for example, in Spain, and see how it has affected them in their everyday life. And it's not something that classical liberal sympathizers will feel comfortable with.
Or as Jack Schaefer refers to me, public radio talk show hosts.
Maybe. But that is a growing response to white supremacist presence that has grown in alarming ways in our country.
Antifa was a group, one of the major groups that was confronting the right groups of the KKK and the white people and the white supremacists that were occupying the parks there, that were trying to guard against or protest against the taking down of these southern statues. So Antifa was a major group. According to Millie Weaver reporting for InfoWars, live on the site there, and I was watching that report live, Antifa started throwing feces and urine and things like that at some of the protesters on the right. And so Katie Couric even did a Twitter to that effect, but not would specify in her Twitter announcement that who exactly had done it. According to Millie Weaver, it was the Antifa group that was causing most of the violence at Charlottesville, Virginia. And that was someone on the site. In fact, her cameraman got pepper sprayed, and so they knocked him out of commission. And so this is what we're having to confront, is that there's a lot of disinformation out there. Now that the press is down to about, the media down to 6 conglomerates, and they're all against Trump, then you're not going to get much out of those mainstream media outlets. You have to go to these alternative, you could say, medias. And that's where that alternative right was created, by Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. So they took this alternative media and morphed it into alt-right. See, and then that, now they're taking this alt-right, they're mating them up with the KKK and all that, and then they're saying that by Trump's statements, he conflated those things together, or actually the press is conflating all of these different negatives together with the Republican Party and trying to recharacterize and redefine the Republican Party, but in a very, very diabolical way. Now, the next clip came from the Meet the Press last Sunday with Chuck Todd, and Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, is being interviewed by Chuck Todd, and along with them is Mark Bray, who is the Antifa, you could say, represents that concept and that movement. And he states specifically on there that he favors and he supports violence. He says it outright. And Richard Cohen says that's crazy to come to these kinds of events and confront people that are exercising free speech, even though they're the Klan and all that. He says that's crazy to confront them with this violence-prone group. So I want you to listen to that right now.
Welcome back. As we've noted, there's been much discussion over President Trump blaming, quote, both sides for the violence in Charlottesville. Neo-Nazis, the KKK, sadly those are groups whose names and hateful ideologies are fairly well known. But what was the other side? Well, some of those left-wing activists belong to an anti-fascist movement known as Antifa, which advocates confronting white supremacism, sometimes with force. So joining me now are Richard Cohen, he's president of the Southern Poverty Law Center and an expert on domestic hate groups, and Dartmouth University lecturer Mark Bray. He's the author of the upcoming book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. So, gentlemen, I kind of want to have almost parallel conversations with you. Mark, with you on Antifa, and Richard, with you on what did the right-wing hate groups hear yesterday. So, Richard, let me start with you before I get to Antifa. What did they hear when the president said what he said yesterday? What did the KKK hear, these new alt-right groups, whatever you want to call them?
Yeah, they've heard the same tune that the president's been singing since Saturday. They love it. They think the president is not condemning them, that he is defending them. He's saying, look, there are bad guys on the other side. The other people who the media, Chuck Todd, is criticizing, mm-hmm. they're no worse. He's really bullying them.
Have you seen, other than their statements, have you seen new activity? Is there evidence that somehow this is a growing movement? or is it a loud movement that suddenly we're giving a microphone to?
Two things I would say. First, Trump has tremendously energized the white supremacist movement in this country. There's never been a candidate in recent memory who's been endorsed by the KKK, who people have rallied to. On the other hand, after Charlottesville, we saw some people back away because they don't want to be associated with kind of death and destruction. So it's going to continue because Trump has really pumped a lot of life into it.
When you say back away, who backs away? Are there sort of milder white supremacist groups?
Well, sometimes they're called the alt-light. And some of those people, like, for example, have backed away from the demonstration in Boston. Someone who was planning some anti-Google demonstrations has said, no, I don't want to do it because I don't want to be associated with Charlottesville. So we're seeing, some people are backing away. On the other hand, some people are emboldened by this and are itching for a fight in Boston, itching for a fight in San Francisco. I think it's going to be ugly.
Well, speaking of that fight, let's go to that issue there. Mark Bray, you are writing this book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Explain this movement and its roots.
Right. So anti-fascism goes back to the beginning of the 20th century when leftists of all stripes fought back against Mussolini and Hitler. Most people think of Nazism as something that died with World War II, but it really rebranded itself, grew again in a lot of European countries, in the United States. And so the modern Antifa movement grows out of the 70s and 80s in Great Britain and Germany when a lot of immigrants, when a lot of leftists, punk rockers had to physically defend themselves from neo-Nazi attacks, predominantly through skinheads. And that's where it grew, and that's where we can trace its lineage from today. The main perspective of Antifa is essentially that rather than simply waiting for the threat to materialize, you stop it from the beginning. You say no platform for fascism, and that's what we're seeing with the attempts in Charlottesville and elsewhere.
I'm curious, first of all, are you an advocate of this sort of confrontation?
Yes, I am. Yes.
What do you say to those that are concerned that, hey, you're allowing these white supremacists to claim victimhood here? What do you say to that criticism, since the president is trying to essentially create a false equivalency here?
Well, I think there's two parts of it. One is how do far-right movements grow? I say they grow by becoming normalized, by not being confronted, by being able to present themselves as family-friendly and respectable. So part of the reason why the alt-right called themselves alt-right is to present that mainstream image. And the opposition that people showed in Charlottesville really marred and tainted that. So I think that by showing up and confronting it prevents the ability of being able to be presented as mainstream. And connected that, I think really you need to be able to prevent them from being able to organize. People who are involved in politics know that for movements to expand, they need to be able to organize and grow. And if you stop that, it prevents it. Historically, we can see that Nazism and fascism was not stopped by polite dialogue and reasoned debate. It had to be stopped by force. And unfortunately, self-defense is necessitated in the context that we're seeing today.
You know, Mark, you didn't see this, but Richard was shaking his head no. Why do you say that is not the right way to confront these white supremacist groups?
I think fighting fire with fire under these circumstances is going to lead to what we saw in Charlottesville. You know, when I look at how the clergy reacted to the alt-right there, when I look at how many of the student groups reacted to the alt-right, we don't need the Antifa to come and, you know, make a spectacle out of it to embolden these people. They love it. That's why they came with helmets on and shields, because they want to portray themselves as martyrs. They want to portray the white race as being embattled. The idea that we want to encourage the Antifa to come with clubs, and all due respect to the professor, it seems crazy to me.
Right, but address Mark's other point here. Well, Mark, you go ahead. I was going to get him to respond to your other point, which is the historical aspect of fascism has only been defeated with violence, right? I assume that's the argument you'd make, right, Mark?
Sure. If our other guest wants to respond, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I would say is, you know, we have the police, we have law enforcement, and if the neo-Nazis act violently, we can depend upon them to shut them down. These people have a right to espouse their ideas. Hate is not illegal in this country. Hurting people is illegal, and we have First Amendment rights, and we can't squelch them by having people show up at rallies with clubs.
Mark, I'll go ahead and give you the last word.
Yeah, so, I mean, if no one is praising the Weimar Republic for giving Nazis the right to assemble, no one is really lauding that. We're looking back and saying, isn't it unfortunate that this threat was not taken seriously earlier and stamped out before millions of people could be killed? That's the historical argument that I make, and I'd rather have people confronting them than sitting idly by. There are no great memoirs written of the people who sat idly by and watched Nazism rise to power.
Are you at all concerned, though, about the rise in violence, that violence begets violence? Mark?
Self-defense is important. I'm more concerned. I mean, look at Cornel West. He said that the anti-fascists defended them from being run over and attacked. So I think the notion that people are seeing the self-defense as being counterproductive is not entirely true. And I think self-defense is important. Fascism shows it is violence incarnate. It will come after us when we defend ourselves.
I have to say, you gentlemen have been great. I appreciate your expertise. I can't believe it's 2017 and we're having to have this conversation. That's what's amazing
unfortunate.
Here, unfortunately. Richard Cohen,
thank you,
Todd. Poverty Law Center, Mark Bray over at Dartmouth. Thank you both
thank you.
For coming on and sharing your views.
That was pretty straightforward there with Richard Cohen and Mark Bray being interviewed by Chuck Todd on Meet the Press Daily last Sunday. So we're seeing this built up, but there are people, and I'll say this about Richard Cohen. I don't support the Southern Poverty Law Center because they have been involved in many intelligence operations in the past that we've uncovered. The Elohim City, they had advance notice of that and so forth before the Oklahoma bombing. But we won't get into that at this point. But Richard Cohen did confront Mark Bray, who is the Antifa proponent and supporter and, you know, founder of that movement in America or whatever. And he did say that it's crazy. It's just crazy, outright crazy to bring weapons and confrontational and a violence-prone type of attitude to those kinds of demonstrations. And so this is important that we take notice of these kinds of you could say, opinions, see. And because what is happening is that Peacock years ago wrote a book on the ominous parallels. And in that book, he compared the buildup to the Nazi regime in Nazi Germany, beginning before 33, in the 20s, you could say. The brown shirts and the meetings down at the Hofbräuhaus in Munich by Hitler and all those people. And then the consolidation of that movement into a political viable party called the Nazi Party. Now that Nazi Party was a National Socialist oriented party. So it came from the left. So many of the people are confused about that sometimes. And your liberals make that error. They err there. They always think the Nazi Party came from the right. But it came from the political left. It was competition with the communist left in Germany under the Weimar Republic. But basically what happened, and it was tragic for Germany, was that as Hitler's political seats in the parliament multiplied into not a two-thirds majority, but a slight majority. He began to control parliament. And Hindenburg at the time was the president, but he was sick. And he ends up deferring to much of what Hitler wanted to do. And so basically what was going on is that Hitler was trying to find ways to consolidate his power in a pre-Nazi Germany. It was the build-up there that was occurring. So around 33 or so, we had the burning of the Reichstag, and this was blamed on the leftist, communist left. And at all times it was done on a secret mission by Hitler and his cohorts. See, we found this out much later, many years later. But Hitler and the Nazi Party used that then to promulgate what they call the Enabling Act, okay? And the Enabling Act actually began the takeaway and the takedown of the constitutional rights of the average German citizen. And so, but to get that voted through Parliament, and they did vote it through Parliament in a legal way, it took 2/3 majority to vote that through. Well, the Nazi Party didn't have the 2/3, but they did have the 2/3 if they combined their vote with the Central Party. Now, the Central Party at that time was supported, and it was the party of the Catholic Church. Okay? So we see a partnership develop between the Catholic Church and the Nazi Party to get that Enabling Act through. And that Enabling Act had several articles. And I'm putting this up on our site tonight. You'll be able to go in and download, you could say, a PDF file that will have a list of those, basically in German versus the English, of those articles in a simplified form. And you'll be able to see how those actually transform or transmogrified Germany into a dictatorship ruled over by Hitler. All the time that he was promulgating fascism, see, the idea of fascism versus other political systems was that the individual would have to subjugate his individual freedoms and rights to the state. So it was an ultra-statist system with an all-powerful centralized government. And if you'll go in and look at some of the speeches that Hitler was making early on at the Soldatenfeld in Nuremberg, you'll see that that was the theme of many of his speeches, that you as Germans must sacrifice for a greater Germany, see, and things like that. And so this is the way he sold it. And Mussolini's idea was similar to that in Italy. So what they did was they convinced the German people to do that. Now, in Hitler's consolidation at the beginning of the Nazi Party, he allied with labor unions, okay? And so it not only was a National Socialist idea, but it incorporated labor because of the socialism, see? So he took over, he was able to attract the labor unions and that labor support early on in his rise to power. Later on, he enacted the Enabling Act, which had a couple of, it did have an expiration on it also, the Enabling Act did. So it expired in 37, okay? But at the end of that expiration, they just renewed it again because he was even more powerful. But the Enabling Act had a couple of paragraphs that I think that are very, very cogent to our discussion tonight. And Article 3 of the Enabling Act stated this, okay, start of the quote here. Laws enacted by the Reich government shall be issued by the Chancellor. And actually, Hitler at the time of the Enabling Act had become Chancellor of Germany, okay, shall be issued by the Chancellor, which was Hitler, and announced in the Reich Gazette. That was a newspaper. They shall take effect on the day following the announcement, unless they prescribe a different date. And then it says Article 68 to 77 of the Constitution do not apply to laws enacted by the Reich government. So it had become, through the Enabling Act, a government by dictates. See, and Hitler was dictating and became absolute dictator later. Article 4 was treaties of the Reich with foreign states which relate to matters of Reich legislation shall, for the duration of the validity of these laws, not require the consent of the legislative authorities. The Reich government shall enact the legislation necessary to implement these agreements. So what he did was he took away from the parliament at the time any right about negotiating with foreign states, see, and he put that in his own hands, see. So what you have here is a complete takeover eventually. And in writing Ominous Parallels, Peikoff pointed out many of the problems and similarities, okay, that existed, okay, at the time of the Nazi problem and what exists today in America. And it's really very, very eerie and haunting, his predictions. because we've also interviewed Robert Paxton, and we're going to play that for the second hour again. We've replayed it several times lately, but I feel so saddened by the state of affairs of our country that we're going to replay that again. And Charlotte and I interviewed Robert Paxton, author of The Anatomy of Fascism. And he says fascism takes different forms in different countries. So it may not resemble in this country what that rise to power of a fascist type of entity could take the form of coming from the left. In other words, the very leftists that are accusing, say, Trump of fascism may be the rise of the real fascist movement. And that's what's really dangerous in this recent state of affairs. Peikoff goes on to within his book of Ominous Parallels, and I'll just read briefly some of the points that he made. He said, liberals who demand public control over the use and disposal of private property, Social Security, more taxes, more government control over the energy industry, medicine, broadcasting, etc. And we've seen a steady increase from the liberals of that. Conservatives who demand government control over intellectual and moral life, prayer in the schools, literary censorship, government intervention in the teaching of biology, the anti-abortion movement, etc. We're seeing some of this censorship come out through these social networks now, through these major corporations, and they're beginning to using AI, they're using very, very sophisticated means to look out at some of the posts and deny them access to their system. Number three here, political parties devoid of principles or direction and moved at random by pressure groups, each demanding still more controls. The next one, a progressive anti-intellectual education system that from kindergarten to graduate school creates students who can't read or write. We're producing students that can't read that. Students brainwashed into the feeling that their minds are helpless and they must adapt to society, that there is no absolute truth. We have the verification of that through the closing of the American mind, by Bloom, about this absolute truth. And that morality is whatever society says it is. We've got no more morals today. It's morals or whatever people think they are. Another point. A student radical movement from the 60s through the violent anti-nukes and ecology fanatics of today who are Peikoff maintains the pre-Hitler youth movement is resurrected. The radicals are nature worshippers who attack the middle class, science, technology, and business. The next point, the rise of a defiant old world racial hatred disguised as ethnic identity movement and affirmative action. The next one, a pervasive atmosphere of decadence, moral bankruptcy, and nihilist art accompanied by the rise of escapist mystic cults of every kind, astrology, alternative medicine, orientalist, extrasensory perception, and so forth. We'll have this study guide up on the site tonight, so that you can go along and follow some of these ideas made by Peikoff. But what I'm trying to say here basically is that we've got a country that is being transmogrified, and that's the word to really use, into something that we never planned on seeing. And now this next clip coming up is a clip, and it's amazing. Is Laura really hits on this krauthammer really well. And I'm going to let you listen to that and see what you think, okay? It's coming up next.
To critique what he did today on the grounds that it distracts from the agenda or it was a tactical mistake, I believe, is a cop-out. What Trump did today was a moral disgrace. What he did is he reverted back to where he was on Saturday and made it very clear that what he read on Sunday, was it Monday, 2 days later?
Monday.
Was a hostage tape, clearly reading off a prompter, saying these denunciations by name of the KKK, etc. That wasn't Trump speaking, that was the aide speaking. The reason it's a moral disgrace is this. This generation, for the last 50, 60 years, all the modern presidents, you can go all the way back, you can say Woodrow Wilson was exempt, but beyond that, understood there was something unique about the history of slavery and racism in this country. that we had to cure this original sin. It was not cured by the Civil War as Lincoln had hoped, because it was followed by 100 years of state-sponsored oppression. It began to be cured with civil rights, equality of rights, and this generation, the last 50 or so years, has done a splendid job in redeeming itself. What Trump is missing here is the uniqueness of white supremacy, KKK, and Nazism. Yes, there were bad guys on both sides. That's not the point. This was instigated, instituted. The riot began over a Nazi riot, a Nazi rally. And the only killing here occurred by one of the pro-Nazi, pro-KKK people.
But if you're looking for nuance from this president, he's not going to give you nuance. He's not going to explain to you that some were legally, and you may not like what they're saying, and it's hate speech, and you can disagree with it, but we fought and died for it, and it's protected.
Racism is evil. Those who engage in violence are criminals and thugs. I guess what Charles just said is Donald Trump doesn't mean that. Now, if you're going to say Donald Trump's a racist, or he's stupid, or he's some dumb troglodyte who's just doing a hostage tape, I guess you can tell all our Fox viewers that. And I resent that you just said it was a cop-out, what I said on this set. To critique what he did today is what we were asked to do on the show tonight. I'm not going to pass moral judgment on whether Donald Trump is morally on the same plane as you are, Charles. I'm sure you're a better person than he is. He had a moment today where he could have been calm and could have gone through the facts of what happened again, if necessary, and address the issue of the day, which is to get this infrastructure going in this country. Getting caught in the trap of the left, which was what the media wants us to do, is not going to help a single black person get a job, a single Hispanic person have a better life. We have to be honest about the evil of racism and also honest about the evil of a far left that is trying to tear down both history and intimidate free speech in the country. That is not defending neo-Nazis. It's not defending white supremacists. It's stating a fact about Antifa.
I never said he was defending neo-Nazis. The point is, we're not discussing jobs here. We're not discussing an agenda here. We're discussing the unique role of a president of speaking for the moral conscience of a country, going all the way back to Abraham Lincoln. We're not comparing him to me. We're comparing him to his great predecessors and to the modern predecessors, who in occasions like this would rise to the occasion, speak on behalf of Americans, and denounce unequivocally.
Well, he did that.
The people, yes, but then he tempered it all today. He undid all that by saying, oh, yes, he did it, reading a statement yesterday. But what he really meant is there was anger, violence, evil on both sides.
Laura, your
is missing the point of what occurred here.
Your position is leave the statement as it was made on Monday.
I think his statement yesterday was clear and strong, and I think it was compassionate. I think he should have said it on Saturday. I have no idea why he didn't. But what's been going on in the media, it's not about the statues. It's not about people are offended about the statues. You know, it's about power and control. What's going on with the debate in this country is nothing. People drive by these statues every day. Most people don't even know what's on the statues. But now it's become a symbol. Okay, tear down all the statues. Take them all down. That's what he said today. Now what? Are we going to put people back to work? Great. But white supremacy, evil. Violence, evil. The murder, terrorism, what happened to that poor woman, evil. He's called it all out, but it will never be enough for the people who despise him and his agenda. And there are people on the right and people on the left who do not want him to succeed no matter what. Did he make tactical mistakes? Yes, he did.
You said you have no idea why he didn't say it on Saturday. I'll tell you why he didn't say it on Saturday, which he made plain today. Because that's not what's in his heart.
You really are a PhD.
What he said yesterday was what he was reading off a prompter. He was not asked to do the press conference. His staff was shocked that he went into this. The reason he did it, he has a point to make, and he made it very plain to the country that what he believes and what he feels is what he said on Saturday and not what he read 2 days later.
Well, that was Laura Ingraham, by the way. Forgot to mention her last name there. But Krauthammer is on there, and she massacred him. He's been very, very much a critic of President Trump. And he's a very, very, very nasty person, to tell you the truth. But anyway, she hammered him, and I think put him in his place. And she said it like it was, and the media is going way, way overboard on trying to get rid of Trump for the deep state. When we're talking about the deep state here, we're talking about the intelligence agencies that have virtually taken over the country, along with with the ultra capitalist international financiers. And that is what we're up against now. We're up against a tremendously hidden enemy. And they don't want Trump. He did away with the TPP. He's using executive, he's signing executive statements and orders and stuff like that. And they don't want all that continued on. He's taking away their initiatives. He got us out of the climate change treaty, the Paris Climate Change Treaty. That is one of their big political tools to manipulate people. And they have these children in there for decades in school up until they're in their 20s. And they've had a steady diet of ecological, you could say, persuasion and influences. And so that's what we're up against all the time with the young people, is they've been educated into a secular humanist view, and someone would say cultural Marxism they exhibit that. They exhibit, according to Alan Bloom, who wrote the book The Closing of the American Mind, that every freshman that he met almost up in University of Chicago was espousing that truth is relative. So they've got them into this idea, exactly like Peikoff was saying in Ominous Parallels, that for some reason truth is relative. Some of the other ideas that they've been floating too is that because Trump has lost his moral authority, then the moral authority must be given to us by corporate America. Are you kidding me? The corporations are what Trump is being against. The biggest investment company in the world, BlackRock, out of New York, Larry Fink heading it up, they're the ones that were backing Hillary Clinton. BlackRock manages $4.5 trillion of investments, and that's trillions dollars with a big T. So the big money was behind Hillary Clinton. This surprise, because of the Electoral College and the way it broke out and what Trump did in the remaining, the last weeks of the campaign, put him over the number that he needed to become president. So everybody was even surprised, and even Trump, I believe, was surprised at the way it worked out. They're continuing to hammer him. David Duke is doing a disservice to our president, and he could be a controlled on the right. There's evidence that might be the state. They're accusing Trump of changing the narrative from a neo-Nazi type of group there in Charlottesville to a statuary issue. That's another one of their deals. They're also saying and trying to get the Republican Party conflated with the Klan and so forth and those extreme rightist groups. This is another what they keep hammering away. We're also looking at, you could say, Charlottesville, that crash that occurred there toward the end of the day on Saturday. There are problems involved in that. There's Crowds on Demand, a company out of the West Coast that provides and pays people $25 an hour. We're looking in to seeing if they were involved in this. We don't know for sure if that was the case. They did have a Craigslist ad up for actors in the Charlotte, North Carolina actor. When they were questioned about this, they said no, they had nothing to do with the Charlottesville situation. And so this is ongoing. Remember, feelings are not facts. These emotional things, these tragedies, this loss of this young lady's life and so forth, they become very emotional issues. But they don't always state the facts behind that situation must be developed and to reach a final conclusion. See, and right now there are problems with the Charlottesville crash that occurred. there. And there are people that are looking into this now. And there's all kinds of problems. There's a photograph of the young man that drove the car in his driveway. And then there's this missing black stripe that is going in. The actual crash vehicle was a different vehicle, they think. It goes on and on and on. I'm not going to get in that tonight. But I want to thank everyone out there for trying to grasp this thing. The being able to see and awaken to what's going on out there in this world, you know, in this nation, is very, very difficult to do. And there have been decades, if not this whole last century, of education that has not helped us to come out of this delusional state. I talk about delusion being real. And when I say delusion, I'm talking about, when I say that someone is in a delusional state, I'm saying that they don't have the facts straight, that they've been given or they've been predisposed with a wrong set of facts. See, and so they can't reach a conclusion that is based on facts that will bring them to a correct, truthful conclusion. So it's hard and more difficult to attain the truth in a emotional state than it would be to try to let those emotions pass and then look at the situation and try to develop some facts out of that situation using reason and becoming rational. There are times that emotionals make us irrational and we begin to react emotionally. And that's what the killing of that young lady did, and that plowing in of the car and everything. Those things are so sensational and so forth that they evoke in us a lot of hate and resentment for the people that did that. And then the man that did that is associated with that far right group and the KKK and all that, and they're the bad people, and the good people, the Antifa people, who advocate violence according to their own leaders and the founders of some of the movements. And so it goes like that. It's a confusing thing, but it's purposely done to confuse. This whole system of rule is promulgated on hate and resentment. That's why forgiveness of self and others is all important. When you begin to truly forgive yourself and others, you begin a process. And that process is the dissolving of that false self. And that false self is fueled and nurtured by worldly systems of thinking and hating and resenting. The false self thrives in that atmosphere. So when you begin to really forgive yourself and others, you begin to take that fuel and that nourishment from that false self. Now that false self is fighting like hell to maintain itself and to continue its survivability. And what you must do is you must come back to more and more forgiveness of self and others, and that will eventually you'll reach a state of denial of that false self. So that's basically what we're talking about, and it's hard to do sometimes. So anyway, I want to thank everyone out there in the listening audience. In this second hour, we're going to replay the Robert Paxton Anatomy of Fascism. But thank you very much, and God bless each and every one of you. And life, every life is precious in God's realm. But thank you very much, and good night.